For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. Great to see you. As you may know, we have food. We're going to have a lot of food. So if you feel the desire for some more food, please feel free to get some during the lecture, after the lecture. It's tasty. It's fresh. And the hummus is very good. Welcome. My name is Chris Tires. I'm a professor here in religious studies at DePaul. And I'm also the director of the Center for Religion, Culture, and Community. And we're delighted to have you here tonight to listen to Florence Kaplow. Before I begin, I would like to thank a couple of people who made this event possible. The first person is Charles Strain. Charles, can you just raise your hand here? That says it all. That eow says it all. Charles recently retired from DePaul, but was such a fixture here at DePaul in so many ways, and was instrumental in bringing the center that I now run into existence. And he's also been essential for making connections with the Buddhist community here in Chicago. So it's through Charles, thank you very much, Charles, that I was introduced to Tigan Dan Layton. Tigan? And Tigan has also been doing programming with the CRCC. We were formerly the CIE, Center for Interreligious Engagement, for a number of years. And so we are delighted here at DePaul to continue this relationship with the Buddhist Fellowship in the Chicago area. And we hope to see this continue for many, many years to come. Welcome to Cordelieu Commons. Do not let the portraits fool you. There are a lot of Catholic presidents up here in their Catholic collars, and it looks very Catholic. And it is very Catholic, but one of the beautiful things about DePaul is that within the Catholic tradition and within the Vincentian tradition, there's also a heavy emphasis placed on religious pluralism and respecting people of all faith traditions and no faith traditions. And that is also central to what we do here at DePaul. So it's in that spirit that we're able to have wonderful conversations like the one that we're having tonight. So let me introduce Florence Kaplow. Reverend Zenshin Florence Kaplow is a Soto Zen Buddhist priest and teacher, a Unitarian Universalist minister, and a writer, editor, and essayist. Earlier in her life, she worked as a conservation botanist for 25 years, specializing in the conservation of endangered plants. As a writer, her essays have been published widely, and she has edited two books. Wild Branch is an anthology of nature and environmental writing, and The Hidden Lamp, which is a collection of 100 teaching stories by Buddhist women over 2,500 years, with reflections by contemporary women teachers. And if you're at all interested in these books, they're right over there for your purchase, and she will happily sign your copy of the book. So, and also thanks to the DePaul Bookstore for getting these books to us tonight. As a longtime passionate environmental and climate justice activist, she is engaged in interfaith immigration, racial justice, and environmental justice work. And in times like these, we so need people who do this kind of work. As a conservation biologist, she saw firsthand the early effects of global warming and climate change that have now become, as we all know, irrefutable. Tonight, she will share teachings from the Zen wisdom tradition on living with joy and courage in an increasingly troubled world. We are delighted to have you, Florence. Ladies and gentlemen, Florence Capitol.
I think I'm supposed to do something here. Kagan's motioning to me. I think it's recording, right? Good. Hello, everyone. On this cold, nearly winter's night, I kind of feel like I'm in a Hogwarts scene. I don't know about you. It's pretty wonderful. Although it is funny, as a person who's worked so much on the issue of bringing forth the words and wisdom of women, to be surrounded by all these guys. But it is new days here. I'd like to begin by really thanking the Department of Religious Studies and the Center for Religion, Culture, and Community for inviting me to speak with you this evening. I am truly honored. I was struck by the commitment of the center and of the university to create and host events that reflect our religiously pluralistic world and that address some of the most pressing social issues of our day. These are vitally important conversations, I believe. And I hope that you can stay for a while after the formal talk and engage in that conversation, because we need to have them together. I also want to thank Tygen Dan Layton, the teacher of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, for recommending me as a speaker, and I did notice they brought some flyers if you're interested in learning more about Zen practice. As Chris mentioned in his introduction, I have walked between the worlds of conservation biology and religion for a long time, and between the worlds of Zen Buddhism and the American liberal religious tradition of Unitarian Universalism. I am a sixth generation Midwestern Unitarian. Midwestern Unitarians and Universalists were central in organizing the first Parliament of World Religions in 1893, just a few miles from here, in conjunction with the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. The 1893 Parliament, which I think was a lot more important than the World's Fair, is considered the first interfaith meeting ever between Eastern and Western religious leaders. You could also say that the Parliament was the beginning of the transmission of Buddhist teachings to the West. The great Japanese Rinzai Zen teacher Soen Shaku and five other priests and lay people representing a range of Buddhist traditions from Japan were a delegation to the Parliament, along with other faith leaders from around the world. After hearing Soen Shaku's speech, which was translated into English, a Chicago publisher, Dr. Paul Carew, I think that might be how his name is pronounced, asked Soen Shaku to send an English speaker from Japan knowledgeable about Zen Buddhism to the United States. Soen Shaku sent a student of his, who was also on the faculty at the Tokyo University, whose name was D.T. Suzuki. And D.T. Suzuki's writings over the next 70 years introduced the English-speaking world to Zen. So truly, you as people from Chicago are really part of the way that Zen came to America. I tell this story so that you have a sense of where you are near the very ground of this first transmission and where I stand, a spiritual descendant of the Unitarians and Universalists who helped make that meeting and transmission and transformation possible, and a spiritual descendant of the Zen teachers who came to America as a result of that historic moment here in your city. One of the characteristics I think from what I've seen of religion at this time, is that so many of us walk more than one religious path, maybe over the course of our lifetime, or maybe even simultaneously in various ways. I attended the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California, which has 9 seminaries that come together there, and students have a chance to study across those 9 seminaries. Tigan is actually one of the faculty members at the Institute of Buddhist Studies there from a distance. And it was there that I first heard someone describe themselves as trans-religious. And I felt immediate affinity with that identity as a Soto Zen priest who was also studying for the Unitarian Universalist ministry. And I've also walked between these worlds of science and religion at a time when science and religion sometimes seem at odds with one another. And that remains a strong aspect of my calling as a faith leader and a human being at this particular historic moment of crisis and anxiety. I know that I am not telling you anything you don't already know when I say we are living in perilous times. The rise of authoritarianism around the globe, the extinction crisis, the climate crisis, and many other interrelated perils. As a scientist and climate change activist, I will be speaking largely about the climate tonight and responding to that. But I think the practices that I'm talking about are relevant to them all. So wherever your heart is, wherever your fears are, please, I invite you to take these practices into that area of your life, however it manifests for you. As a conservation biologist and ecologist, I became aware of the research on global warming, as it was called then, as an undergraduate in the 1980s. By the early 1990s, we in conservation science were actively in conversation about its effects on our research, on the work that we were doing, even as the larger culture, and I'm going to put this in quotes, debated it, fueled even then by misinformation and doubt that we now know was being paid for by major corporate interests, and still is. My work involved the study and protection of some of the rarest plants in the world. And it took enormous effort to prevent their extinction. I had found plants that were new to science and been part of describing them and naming them. And even then, I could see that they could potentially go extinct in my lifetime, due not to the usual culprits of habitat loss and development, which we could do things about, but literally the loss of a climate where they could survive. And indeed, one of the species that I found and named in eastern Washington is now teetering on the edge of extinction as I speak, due to fires that are burning through habitat that didn't used to burn anymore, and hotter summers where the seedlings of this plant can no longer survive. The election in 2000, where Al Gore lost the presidency based on a decision by the Supreme Court to stop a vote recount, broke my heart. I knew that this was not an ordinary election with ordinary results just for this country. I remember saying, this was our last chance to turn things around. In 2008, I turned down a National Science Foundation graduate research fellowship for a PhD in climate ecology and genetics, a full ride for 4 years of graduate study. I had people tell me I was crazy to go into Unitarian Universalist ministry. I was already at that point a Soto Zen priest as well. I no longer wanted to study the ways that the world was falling apart. I wanted to inspire people to act and help people learn to create forms of community to support one another through the storm that the world was doing so little to address. My work as a minister brings me into contact with people across a wide spectrum of generations. It continues to surprise me how much talking seriously and openly about what is happening is still relatively rare. If you are at a dinner party, I would venture to suggest that it is more socially acceptable to talk about sex or money than it is to talk about the climate. I was honored to be the speaker at the climate strike at the University of Illinois on September 20th of this year. Most of the other speakers were college students, and they talked very openly about the impact to their lives, on their choice of study, and on their hopes for the future. And they were angry, and they were right to be angry. That energy felt strong and powerful to me, even encouraging in a strange way, because anger in some ways is the opposite of despair and powerlessness. It seeks to right something that has gone terribly wrong and to respond to it. It is not the energy of giving up, of passivity, of tuning out. Wherever you are right now, each and one of you, angry or hopeful or despairing or tuned out, although honestly, I don't think you'd be here if you were tuned out. I hope this talk will inspire you to find your courage and your steadiness for the hard road we are all on. You, each and every one of you, are desperately needed in these times. I mean this. These humble words are just meant to encourage you. People tend to think that spiritual practices and engagement with the world are at opposite ends of the spectrum. People really tend to think that Buddhism is all about sitting quietly and withdrawing from the world, letting go of our passionate care for the world for some kind of inner development. This has not been my experience. My experience over 30 years of intensive Buddhist practice is that it is precisely those practices and teachings that have made it possible for me to continue to be engaged in the heartbreaking work of environmental activism and work for justice, and now the difficult work of ministry, without turning away, without descending into cynicism or apathy, or erupting into rage, although those feelings do arise now and again in my life. I am going to offer to you tonight 5 practices for these troubled times. These are my gifts to you. Please take what is useful and leave the rest. I don't generally believe in giving advice. We're taught in ministry that nobody listens anyway. So please forgive me for bringing this to you, and know that this advice is as much for me as it is for you. I see all these practices as coming from Zen or Buddhist understandings, but they are also just plain old human wisdom for hard times. Really good wisdom knows no religious boundaries. They have been helpful for me. Perhaps they will be helpful for you. And I also promise, as I said, there will be time for conversation and questions and ways that you can add to this after the talk. These 5 are: 1, facing what is happening. 2, practicing not knowing. Number three, cultivating gratitude. Number four, slowing down. And number five, taking care of one another. And I have to say, you know, it's really fun having a chance to speak for longer than the it used to be that when ministers spoke, there was kind of an expectation of maybe a half an hour, and then it was about 20 minutes, and then about 15 minutes. And now in my church, if you go much beyond 10 or 12 minutes, they start getting restless. So thank you for your patience, for allowing me to talk at you for a longer time. In working on this talk, I realized that I carry a lot in my heart that I would love to share, and to have a chance to really do that fully is a real gift. Number one, facing what is happening. This one is the hardest and the hardest to talk about, so please stay with me. I promise it will get more encouraging later in the talk. We seem to have a species-specific, infinite capacity to avoid hard truths, to practice willful blindness. We are all, as the old joke goes, queens of denial, if you ever heard that one. You can think about it for a minute. It must be somehow evolutionarily advantageous, but I'd venture a guess that it is not any more advantageous. In Zen, we have teaching stories called koans. And there's one from this book of koans about women and women's practice, The Hidden Lamp, that comes to mind when I ponder our difficulty with seeing things as they are. In this brief story from 9th century China, a Zen nun goes to see a famous teacher and is not satisfied with his answer to her heartfelt question. I think there's a real question in the story: who is more woke to the way things are? See what you think. It's called Ling's Question. Ling Jingpo visited Master Fubei Heisheng to pay her respects. They sat together and drank tea, and she asked him, "If a true word can't be spoken, no matter how hard you try, how will you teach?" Fubei said, "Fubei has nothing to say." Ling was not satisfied. She placed her hands inside the opposite sleeves of her robe and cried out, "There is grievous suffering, even within a blue sky." Again, Fubei had nothing to say. Ling said, "To be a human being is to live in calamity." To be a human being is to live in calamity. Wow, she doesn't mess around, does she? Old Ling from 9th century China. And yet we know this. The cancer diagnosis, the call in the middle of the night, the drumbeats of disaster. But I think most of us muddle through by thinking of these things as aberrations, mistakes, little or big hiccups in an otherwise okay situation, right? And I think one thing that's helpful to know in this story and about Zen generally is that it developed and flowered in China during very tumultuous times, towards the end of the first millennium. War and political chaos were sweeping over China again and again. It was easy to end up on the wrong side and find yourself exiled or worse. There was nothing safe about those times, just like these times. And Zen, with its earthy, practical, iconoclastic, sometimes humorous, active teachings, was particularly good medicine for people at those times. So maybe it has something to teach us in these times. Poor Fubei in that story is trying his best to be a spiritual master, to play the part of the wise spiritual teacher, just like me up here. But Ling, who knows what Ling has lived through, is having none of it. She doesn't see his silence in the face of human suffering as wise. She sees right through him and tells him so. A later famous teacher, Nanchuan, said in a commentary on this koan, "Poor Fubei, he was devastated by the woman. Poor Fubei indeed. Poor us. There is great suffering even within a blue sky. We can't afford silence or denial in times like these. It doesn't help us, whether in relation to the rise of authoritarianism or the climate or any number of our other troubles. The first step, always the first step in the spiritual life, and for that matter, in the recovery life as well, for anyone who has worked with addiction, and I think we could say we're all addicted in one way or another, is to wake up to what is. I think this is happening right now in many places as I speak to you. Over the last 2 to 3 years, I've watched people's concerns about the climate, formerly called the shockingly neutral term climate change. I heard recently that that was actually deliberately developed by somebody who was trying to make us less concerned. And now more and more called what it really is, or climate crisis, or climate emergency, has risen from a background concern to a foreground concern for all generations. And we're seeing that in polling data as well. But I noticed there is a different intensity of the feeling depending on the generation. Older generations may suffer about this, may worry about their children or grandchildren or those most vulnerable around the world, but those of you who are millennials or younger know that this is about the rest of your life. You are, as we say in Zen, intimate with this reality. It is not far away. And this is becoming increasingly true for everyone. I want to share a few words from an email I received this week from a 90-year-old Buddhist friend who lives in Mill Valley, California, north of San Francisco. She has lived nearly all her life high on a ridge on Mount Tamalpais. She and her husband built the house she's in now at the end of a very, very steep and winding road. I have to tell you, every time I hear about fires in Northern California, I worry for my friend. And Mill Valley is now filled with people of nearly unimaginable wealth and privilege. But in the last week, even they have begun to directly experience the results of climate change. It was surreal to read her words about her experience. "We were totally out of power for 4 days, but came back on about 2 hours ago. What a relief. My solar, still down as I wait and I wait and I wait, this time for the parts. I hope to get installed again before the next outage, which they predict. It won't end until the rains come, and no sign of them yet. Big help to me was the landline I still have. Most cell towers were down, and everything and everyone just froze in place, except for the food in the fridge. But I could make calls, which didn't do much good since recipients all had cell phones. Also, proud owners of electric cars were in a tizzy because not able to charge. No power to pump gas in Marin, and San Francisco Station sold out. Grace Cathedral and St. Mary's opened as shelters for the displaced from Santa Rosa and vicinity. It has been an interesting experience. Thank you for your concern, but all well. And it was a big wake-up call, which was needed. Much love and brave hopes for the future, Sally. I love how she ends this dystopian description. Don't you feel like you're hearing something out of a science fiction novel? This is north of San Francisco. With a wake-up call, much needed, and much love, and brave hopes for the future. That's my friend Sally. And then her next email was this. A very positive community note. Mill Valley Market, may they be forever blessed, rented a generator and installed 6 outlets outside the market so people could come by day or night and charge their phones. Of course, the power did save all the produce and frozen stuff, but it also gave people a place to find food. Manager told me he had 3 chefs working in their kitchens. Many Mill Valley inhabitants now do not know how to cook for themselves and are dependent upon local restaurants and coffee houses for their nutritional needs. Only other place open in Mill Valley was a coffee house with a generator. And when I came in asking about ice deliveries, the same man went into the back and got ice from the market's own store and gave it to me. One of the most important and encouraging books I know was written by a former speaker in this same series, Rebecca Solnit. The book's called A Paradise Built in Hell. And I put it on your reading list. I really recommend it. Where she describes a number of disasters. You're wondering why am I recommending this? But you'll hear. From the San Francisco earthquake of 1906 to Hurricane Katrina and 9/11, and the extraordinary acts of human kindness and altruism that happen during those times. Sally's email reminds me of that. Sometimes it takes a crisis for us to break down the walls between us. Okay, we have all survived practice number 1, seeing what is. Practice 2, practicing not knowing. I realized it seemed a little strange to be talking about not knowing on a university campus, which is all about acquiring knowledge, after all. And what does this have to do with climate change anyway? Isn't not knowing part of what got us into this mess? But here's another Zen koan. This one very famous about not knowing. Dijong asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dijong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fayan said, "I don't know." Dijong said, "Not knowing is most intimate." I would say that one of the biggest problems with our very, very, very big human brains is that they function as very inaccurate prediction machines. But we forget about the inaccurate part all the time. How much time do you spend every day imagining a difficult conversation that you need to have with your partner or a coworker, filling in exactly how you are sure they will respond in their part of the conversation? How many billions of dollars of our economy goes towards the books written and the talks given by pundits? Political pundits, military pundits, economic pundits, telling us what is going to happen in the future. And honestly, if you look back, what kind of batting average do they actually have? Remembering that your predictions only bear a marginally accurate relationship to the infinitely complex nature of reality can powerfully and positively affect your daily life and your relationship to the future on any scale. Predictions are the way that human beings have evolved to try to keep ourselves safe. You know, that's right. Last time I went by that river, there was a saber-toothed tiger. I better not go that way again. Right? That's where it came from, that capacity of the human mind. But at the cost of actually being intimate with life as it unfolds. What would your relationship with your partner or coworker be like if you allowed them to show up free of your stories about how they will react or speak, allowing them the great freedom to surprise you for once? Okay, I have to admit that in relation to the climate and some of our global problems, things do indeed look grim. And I was, after all, just saying how important it is to face what is. But it's also important to know that we do not know the end of the story yet. We don't even know past the first chapter of the story yet. Another book of ideas that has sustained me in the last few years is called The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, where he argues that almost everything that has happened in history and even in economics has evaded prediction. And he has lots of mathematics to prove it, if you like mathematics. After something happens, it looks obvious, right? That, oh, of course, that's how we got there in this very orderly fashion. No. We make history afterward. And that's why it looks orderly, because it's already happened. No one, or nearly no one, predicted the sudden collapse of the Berlin Wall or the end of the era of apartheid in South Africa, or many other sudden revolutions and changes. And it is not too late. It will never be too late to have an effect on the course of the world's trajectory. Even climate change, the difference of even 1 degree or a half degree of global warming will affect an almost limitless number of human beings and other creatures. Every decision you make, and I'm not talking like general you, I'm talking you, make matters. And no one knows the decision that could turn the tide. Every delay is precious. Who could have predicted the phenomenon of Greta Thunberg, anyway, who just a little over a year ago was all by herself on the street having a one-girl climate strike action? When I think of Greta Thunberg, I think of the child in the story of the Emperor's New Clothes. Do you all remember that story? I'm going to tell it to you again, because we need a little fairy tale here, I think, at this point. It begins like this. Many years ago, there was an emperor. By the way, if this reminds you of anything in current events, please, that's not the intention. There was an emperor so exceedingly fond of new clothes that he spent all his money on being well-dressed. He cared nothing about reviewing his soldiers, going to the theater, or going for a ride in his carriage, except to show off his new clothes. He had a coat for every hour of the day. And instead of saying, as one might about any other ruler, the king's in council, here they always said, the emperor's in his dressing room. Two swindlers came to town, and realizing the opportunity, they go to the emperor and tell him that they will make him a magnificent suit that will be invisible to anyone who was unfit for their office or unusually stupid. Then they set up their looms and began weaving nothing. All the courtiers, of course, exclaim at the beautiful clothing. When the emperor goes to see, he can't see anything. But he doesn't want to admit that maybe he can't see because he is unfit for his office, so he exclaims of its beauty too. They have him take off all his clothes, and put on the new suit to parade through town, naked. Everyone in town lined the streets and pretended to see the beautiful clothing as well, except one child, who said to his father very quietly, "But he hasn't got anything on." "Did you ever hear such innocent prattle?" said his father. But then one person whispered to another what the child had said. "He hasn't anything on. A child says he hasn't anything on. But he hasn't got anything on," the whole town cried out at last. That's where we are right now. Right at the point where the child says, "But he hasn't got anything on." And it's happening right in front of us, right in the middle of our lives. Thank you, Greta Thunberg. Number three, cultivating gratitude. The harder and uglier things get, the more important the absurdly simple practice of gratitude becomes. When I teach, which I do regularly, about Buddhist practices for cultivating happiness, I will tell people when I get to gratitude that they can forget everything else and just do this one thing. And yes, you have a right to some happiness even when things are falling apart in your life personally or in the world. There are 1,000 ways to practice gratitude, or as Rumi wrote, there are 100 ways to kneel and kiss the ground. You can keep a gratitude journal. You can spend time before going to sleep considering things that happened that day for which you are grateful. You can have time with family or friends over a meal where each person mentions one thing that they're grateful for. Like most practices, most good spiritual practices, it does not need to be elaborate. Even a little gratitude goes a long way. Someone at the Zen Center, Ancient Dragon, here told me when I spoke on some of this material a few months ago, last year, about the simplest practice of all that he learned from a theater director he worked with. No matter what happened, from the greatest triumph to the most fouled up opening of a new play, to say to oneself, "Yay! Just yay! I've been trying it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't." And let's face it, as hard as our lives sometimes are, there are immense things to be grateful for, always. Things that many human beings do not have, but that I suspect every person in this room has. Clean water, beauty, a dry place to sleep, food, family, security. None of us know the future, but we can love the present with all our hearts. I remember when the Iraq War was imminent. Many people I knew were deeply despairing, and with good reason. We were about to go in and destroy the country of another people who had done very little to justify our ferocity. I kept saying, "Every day that the war has not yet started is a good day. I will do everything in my power to speak out and keep it from happening, and if it does, then I will mourn. But for now, I celebrate that it has not yet happened." You can be grateful for what has not yet happened. The most powerful and also most sorrowful conversation I have had about this was with a young woman I am close to and her husband. She teaches environmental policy, and they have a beautiful and lively one-year-old daughter. She told me that not long before, an older woman was musing about the time far in the future when my friend's daughter would be a grandmother. And my friend realized, because of her own background and knowledge, that she had a strong feeling that the world was likely to change in ways that would mean that her daughter might not live that long, that her daughter's life would be difficult in ways that she couldn't imagine. But then my friend said the most extraordinary thing. She said, I think about this all the time, but I have no regrets about bringing her into the world. She is precious, no matter how long or short her life is, no matter what happens. My love for her is all the deeper because of knowing this. And I think, oh my goodness, this is the first generation to think this way. And I was also reminded of a beautiful Japanese Zen poem that I have shared at more than one memorial of a young person when grief was palpable in the room. The morning glory that blooms for an hour is not different at its heart from the giant pine that lives for 1,000 years. This is living fully in the world as it is, with love and courage, not turning away. You can celebrate the world as it is now, even diminished as it is. This is really to me, as well as to you. It's hard as a biologist because you see it even more clearly. You can celebrate that the monarchs are gathering once again in Mexico right now, even if there are fewer of them. That the shorebirds are traveling on their 5,000-mile migration still from one pole to another. That the aspens are turning the mountains of the West golden as they have for more millennia than we have been a species. You can celebrate the laughter of your child at some new wonder. There are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Number 4, practice, slowing down. As a lot of people said after the 2016 election, this is not a sprint, this is a marathon. And in a marathon, and I'll admit, I've never run a marathon, but this is what people have told me, you need to be sure to get enough water and pace yourself. Same with mountaineering, which I have done. Rest breaks are essential. When you get up at high elevation in mountaineering, you actually have to rest at each step. You don't need to feel guilty about resting because rest is the ground you need to go on. Many of us are moving so fast and so frantically, either in an attempt to survive economically or to address the wrongs around us, that spiritual practices become an afterthought. I am convinced, truly convinced, this is the one place where maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, that someone out there is trying to get us to never rest, to never stop watching TV or surfing the net or checking our cell phone, so that we won't stop and think about what's happening and do something to change it. So, consider rest a radical act. Walk in the woods, cuddle with your loved ones or your dog, drink a cup of tea, eat a raisin with full awareness, and know that you are not turning away from the troubles of the world. When you do those things, you are strengthening yourself for the journey and the struggle. I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, but it's a great story. It's said that Gandhi used to meditate for an hour a day, no matter what. But one day there was a big political action coming up, and his followers said, "Today is so busy that we won't be meditating, right?" And he said, "Today is so busy, we will be meditating for 2 hours." Tigan thinks that's funny. And maybe you're saying to yourself, "I can't meditate, that's just not my thing." And certainly not for 2 hours. I am here to tell you really good news. There is such a thing as homeopathic meditation. Even a moment of presence goes a very, very long way. Years ago, I was asked to help start a small weekly sitting group for mothers of young children, actually in that same town of Mill Valley. And most of those women did not have any kind of regular meditation practice, and their life was just as hard and stressful as if any of you are parents or were once parents of young children, you might remember. The only time of the week that they stopped was in that time that we had together. We sat in silence for half an hour, and then they shared about their lives. Before I was part of this group, I really thought you needed to spend time in deep retreat or in a monastery for radical transformation. But over the years, I saw their lives and relationships change noticeably and powerfully. They had more capacity. They had less reactivity. And their hearts were softer towards themselves and others. With just a half hour of silence and presence together every week. Even a breath can be a moment of Sabbath and pause. Even connecting with the feeling of your feet on the ground can be a moment of solace and grounding. So, advice number 4, find a way to slow down and be present, whether you call it meditation or a walk in the woods or drinking a cup of tea. Your adrenal glands will thank you, if no one else. And number 5, taking care of one another. Sometimes they say that ministers only have 1 or 2 sermons that they say over and over in different ways throughout their careers. I think one of mine is take care of one another. This is what my longtime Zen teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, taught me. That the more deeply you look within at your own experience, the more it is clear that we are all connected, that we are all dependent on one another, and that our salvation, in every sense of that word, is bound up together. As Gandhi said, those who say spirituality has nothing to do with politics do not know what spirituality really means. And the longer I practice this strange ancient practice of Zen, the more my heart opens. I want to be a person who weeps when she reads the newspaper, or who weeps when she stands at a demonstration, because there are things worth weeping over. When I ordained as a Zen priest and asked my teacher what it meant to be a priest, he said, "We weep." Many centuries ago, a student asked his teacher, "What is Zen?" And the teacher said, "An appropriate response." What is the appropriate response right now? I can't tell you. That is for you to find out in your own life. But I don't think it's turning away, and I don't think it's drowning in fear or anger. I do think it has something to do with reaching out and taking the hand of someone near you who might be more frightened and despairing than you are. I do think it has something to do with recognizing that refugee children held in detention are just as worthy of our love and commitment as our own children are. I do think it has something to do with recognizing finally that we have much more in common than we have differences, and that what we have most in common is this gorgeous and imperiled planet. We no longer have the luxury of being at each other's throats. Our ordinary life often leaves us isolated and alone, even as we are supposedly connected through the internet and cell phones. We know this with the news articles about epidemics of loneliness and depression and even suicide. I wonder how many new friendships were formed in Mill Valley last week as people walked to save gas or huddled in that one coffee shop with the generator, unable to use their phones because the towers were down. It is vitally important to remember that seeing things as they are does not mean only seeing the calamity. It means seeing things as they are, the full range of things as they are, just as Sally did in her emails. This means turning away from our screens and towards real community, whatever that is for you. This is another reason I went into ministry. I have seen how people who are part of a church or a Buddhist sangha or a book club are supported when things go really wrong. An illness, a disaster, with real hand-to-hand support. Or what we Zen people call warm hand to warm hand. It's hard to get a warm hand through the cell phone. You know what I mean? Just not the same. We must relearn the skills of community and broaden our definition of community as wide as we can possibly take it. Perhaps you know the story that the Vietnamese Zen teacher and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh tells about boat people fleeing Vietnam after the war, facing pirates and shipwreck and small and leaky boats, just like the refugees crossing the Mediterranean now. He said, and he was speaking from experience, from the many, many refugees that he had known, that if even one person could stay calm on one of those boats, the likelihood that all would survive was immeasurably greater. What can you do to be that one person for your community, for your family, for the world? I want to close with a reading from the Buddhist teacher Jack Kornfield. You are not alone. You have generations of ancestors at your back. You have the blessedness of interdependence and community. You have the great trees of the forest as steadfast allies. You have the turning of the seasons and the renewal of life as your music. You have the vast sky of emptiness to hold all things graciously. Now it is the time to step forward, bringing your equanimity and courage, wisdom and compassion to this world. Thank you.
Some question and answer period. In the spirit of gratitude, first let me thank you for your wonderful comments. I also want to thank Paige Hall Petrie, who is sitting right over here, who is the mastermind behind all of the details, the sound system, the food, the posters, the bookstore. So thank you, Paige, for all of your help. Paige and I will be passing around some evaluation forms. We'd love to get your feedback on what you heard today, if you have any suggestions for what you would like to see in terms of future programming. And it's a way for us to stay in contact with you. We don't sell your information to anyone. This is a closed listserv. And so we'd love to stay in contact with you to let you know what other CRCC events are coming up down the line. So Paige and I will pass those around right now. But let's go ahead and open it up. We have about 20, 25 minutes for question and answers. Are there any questions or comments?
I'd be interested in hearing, what are your practices? I know there's some wise people in this room. None of us make it past about 15 without developing a little bit of wisdom. And I think everybody in here is over 15. So please share, or anything else you want to bring up. We're all in this together. Yes. Oh, you know what? I see a handy thing that will make it possible for people to hear you. I think it needs to be turned on. Hold that wisdom. There we go. Yes. Actually, we know, there's science has studied this. The smile actually changes your brain. So you can fake it. Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you think that's changed you to do that practice?
Life is easier.
Life is easier. There you go. That's quite a testimonial. Thank you. Is there someone who feels like running that that around for others when others? Oh, thank you. Oh.
Well, I was actually running around. But I guess if I had the microphone.
Yeah, now you have to say something.
First one is sticking to the things that I love to do. So for me, that is gardening.
Mm-hmm.
All in with plants. And what gives me energy is continuing to be around plants and teaching other people about plants and learning about plants.
You're part of my subspecies. Plant people.
Thank you. Glad to be a part of it. I ask you the second one, because you inspired me. Things I do before I go to bed. So I light my candle right before I go to bed. And I take a glass jar and I put it over the candle. And you can see as the oxygen burns out in within the jar, the flame will slowly get lower and lower. And then you can see the smoke coming from my ground. That's kind of like my signal to my brain that it's time to go to sleep.
And I'll just say, I was just reading about this recently. They're realizing more and more that we have an epidemic of not enough sleep in our culture as well, partly because of these wonderful electric lights and the craziness of our world. And we now know that even a slight degree of sleep deprivation increases anxiety. And so you think about it. We've got an entire culture that is sleep deprived. What does that say about what our energy is going to be like, our level of anxiety is going to be like? So consider, as I said, rest is a radical act. Sleep is a radical act, too, when I struggle with getting enough of.
I guess I do have a question, and it has to do with the first of your practices, the doctrine of yoga. And I know that for myself, part of not turning away, or one of the ways in which I do turn away, let's put it that way, is that I tend to see all the difficulties as being out there. I'd like to see it that way. I would like not to see my involvement and my complicity in these things. But then when I do take a look, I see that I am completely involved. And this does lead to a problem with, I don't know if I would say despair, but extreme frustration in being able to extract myself to not make my own way through the world impeccably, and so on. And so there's always this kind of knot for attention. And I wonder if you could say something to that issue. And I think this is probably something that many people involved in spiritual practice have. Maybe a lot of people in general.
Yeah, I think it's actually a great question. And what I would say is, I have a few different places I go. One is that I think it can be easy to feel that if you can't live a completely pure life, why bother with anything, right, around, okay, you know, there's no way I can be separate. So here are some of the things I hear from people. I'm not saying this is what you're saying, but there's no way I can be non-complicit in the destruction. And it's big corporations that I have no control over that are doing a lot of it anyway. So by God, I am going to fly to Europe every time I want to because it's not really going to make a difference. And I think there are some really wonderful Buddhist teachings around cause and effect. And one of the really, really basic teachings of the Buddha is that every single action of body, speech, and mind has an effect. Now, how that effect manifests is beyond our capacity to comprehend, but it's true. I mean, I don't even think this is a matter of faith. I think if we look carefully, we can see that this is indeed how things work, which could be discouraging because you could feel like, well, and also if you combine that with the fact that we recognize how we're all interconnected, well, then you could feel like everything I do is interconnected to this kind of disaster that's going on. There's nothing I can do. You can turn it the other way, which says that anything I do matters. Any choice I make, no matter how tiny, matters, changes the world in some significant way. So I work with this all the time. One of the hardest things I find around this is that it nearly always seems to involve getting somewhere less quickly and a sort of less efficient life. So, for instance, I take the train now every chance I get. Even I take the train out to the West Coast, I take the train to Colorado, and it turns out I am in love with the train. It's like the most wonderful. I have these amazing conversations with people. I have met the most extraordinary people, including like a 9/11 first responder and Amish people traveling for their 50th wedding anniversary and Zen Buddhists, actually, who turned out to be, you know, distantly related to my version of Zen Buddhism, and Catholic women priests, and on and on, none of whom I would have met had I gotten on a plane. Maybe, you know, maybe there would have been one sitting next to me, but you have a long time on the train across the country to talk with people. And so that's a little choice. You know, am I changing the world doing that? Well, actually, it turns out I am, right? Because each person that I meet changes me. I change them. My not flying train travel is just extraordinarily great in terms of its effect on the carbon budget of the atmosphere. So I think we have to watch our desire for perfection and recognize our utter responsibility, actually, without blaming ourselves, because we are part of this unfolding, right? But we can make a difference. I drive a biodiesel car. I will talk to anybody about biodiesel endlessly. My little ways, right? Each one of us has our little ways. One of my sisters has just absolutely categorically taken a stand that she is no longer using one-use utensils of any kind, cups, glasses, whatever. And she's noticed over the last few years she's less and less alone in this practice, right? So I think to know that those matter, each of those matters. I don't know if that helps. That addresses it. Anybody else have anything to actually add to that conversation? Because I think it's a really interesting one. Oh, fantastic. We've got something from the bookstore.
Yeah. That actually ties into that a little bit. I have a big difficulty. I study environmental sustainability and international affairs. I recently graduated. But one of the biggest issues that I have that I'm struggling with right now are people who don't believe in people who are just doing good for doing good. They don't believe in altruism.
Oof.
And in the face of climate change, when you have people who are more realists, who don't believe that people do good just to do good, how can I change their minds? Should I try to change their minds? Because I feel like that would be something where I'm being kind to someone. I'm trying to spread light. I'm trying to spread positivity, but it takes so much effort. Should I not, in order to be kind to myself?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that can happen in difficult times is the rise of nihilism. And I think I would not call a non-belief in altruism even remotely realistic. I think, actually, what I might do is refer those people to a couple of different really serious research efforts that are happening around altruism and positive states, like the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. There's also one at Stanford, the Center for Compassion and Altruism, I think. Does anybody remember the name of that one? Something very close to that. So there are people doing serious scientific research that shows that this is part of our nature. And just to know that it's one of the defenses, I think, that people bring up in difficult times is a nihilist and deeply pessimistic view of human nature. And what I would do is to feel compassion, because, boy, that's a hard place to live with that view of human nature. Really hard. May they find freedom from it.
Thank you for your talk. I especially loved your practice of gratitude. And I think if gratitude had a sister, she would be in humility.
Oh, beautiful.
I've recently come to realize that one of my practices is being grateful for my own shortcomings, because they're a doorway to compassion for others. You mentioned that we can't afford to be at each other's throats, and the more that I see my own shortcomings, the less able I am to hate people like Donald Trump, the less able I am to hate the powers that fuel climate crisis. Not saying that I am passive in this unfolding. But I think if we're to hear each other, we can't afford to hate each other. The only way that we can actually do something is if we hear each other.
Yes, I agree. And I feel like that, for me, a big part of my Buddhist practice and Zen practice has been that as I look at my own experience and see that every possible human view, including really crazy, unhelpful energies, are in my own mind and body, then it naturally, A, makes me not want to cause more harm than is already out there in the world, because I see how tender we are, how vulnerable we are. But also, you just can't judge righteously in the same way when you've seen it in your own experience. And that's another part of not turning away. It's not turning away with what's in here, what is coming up. It's part of that development of courage. And I love the word, I loved what you said about if gratitude had a sister, she'd be named humility. That's really, really beautiful. I may steal that. Thank you.
I have one question and one request. The question goes back to earlier comments you made about anger, and I'm wondering how Buddhists can cultivate anger as a practice. I'm not sure we're very good at that. That's the question. The request is, I was going over the weekend, going back over the Hidden Land, those wonderful stories in there. And it turns out that my favorite story in there was the one that you commented on.
Ling.
I did not realize.
Oh, my goodness.
So I would hope that the request would be, could you tell us that story?
The one that the blue... Oh, the one that I commented on. Yes, absolutely. So I'll address the first thing first. So anger. I have thought a lot about this, because definitely as a baby Buddhist quite a while ago, I had this thought that a good Buddhist would never get angry about anything. And one of the things that did is it actually, there were a couple of situations that were genuinely not healthy and even harmful for others, that I tried to be a good Buddhist and just like be like, this is my anger coming up, that people are being harmed here. I'm just going to sit with this. That was off base. And one of the things I've come to see, we all have different relationships with anger, right? Our own conditioning, our genetics, whatever. For me, because anger is not my predominant way of meeting the world, I have other things like fear. If I'm angry, there's the not knowing piece, right? I may have my story wrong. That's one possibility. But it's also possible that there's something that genuinely needs to be addressed. Now, how I address that, I think about this all the time as a minister, because ministers have a certain power in the role. And if I come at people with anger, I will do real harm because of also the power of my role. So I might feel angry, which helps me recognize that something is off, that there's something, maybe it's me, maybe it's someone else being harmed in this situation. I work with it so that I can address the wrong, but not with the full heat of my anger, because that almost always goes sideways in my experience. But the anger itself is incredible information. And I do think it's energy. One of the places that I love, I feel like Tibetan Buddhism really understands this, that there are wrathful energies. There's a lot of wrathful energy actually in the women in that book. and that wrathful energy in response to ignorance and cruelty, and that's, if it's clean, if it comes from compassion too, it's appropriate. It's an appropriate response. And sometimes we get it off. So then you asked for the story that I commented on. So this is a beautiful old Chinese koan as well. Everybody in this particular story is nameless. There was an old woman who lived in a hermitage in the forest by herself. And one day a monk on pilgrimage came through the forest and by her hermitage and came in and said to her, old woman, where are your relatives? You have to understand that in China, especially ancient China, every woman was under the control of one of her relatives. So he's asking, where are your minders? Where are your keepers? How can you be all by yourself out here in your hermitage? And she says, my relatives are all around me. Actually, it's funny. I'm sort of forgetting exactly how it goes. But then basically what she says is, the great earth, the plants, the trees, the animals are all my relatives. Those are my... Yes, that's right. She says, my relatives are all around me. And he says, where are they? And then she says, the great earth, the plants, the trees are all my relatives. And I think you probably heard enough from me tonight to have a sense of why I could choose any one of the koans. Actually, there's 100 in the book. There were about 200 altogether. Why I chose that one? Because that's been my life path. I used to say that my work, before I went into ministry and began teaching also in Zen, that my work was to care for the green world, for the non-human world. And now it's expanded to include the human world. Why do you love that one? Go ahead and use the... there's enough of...
She is really as far out in the margins as one can go, right, in that particular society. And I like the idea of Buddhism coming out of the margins and then somewhere else.
That's beautiful. Do you know, in China, I've heard Red Pine, Bill Porter, who's written about the hermits of China, speak. He'd be a wonderful person to have come here. Anyway, one of the things he says is that over and over in China, when things got really, really bad and everything just became a real mess and the whole government structure wasn't working anymore, they would go into the mountains and find a hermit to be the next emperor, recognizing that it was from the margins that at some point you need that wisdom to come in. I don't think any of those emperors were female, but you can always hope. Maybe one more? Okay.
So I'm finding, in the relationships in my life that, when I'm talking, when discussion about one of these difficult concerns comes up, either it's politics or the climate, that it's obviously a very tender and difficult conversation where, people, if people do feel comfortable enough to go there and talk about these things, that there's often people, will have different opinions about it. And I guess my question is, if you have any advice about, when those conversations happen, when either one of us in that conversation is at a point where someone is expressing sort of a sense of hopelessness or a view that is much different than mine that could concern me in some way, where is the line between just listening in that scenario and just, because I realize that that's a helpful thing to do, is just to listen to that conversation, but that also concerns me because, if there's a sense of, okay, we went to this place together that's difficult to go, but neither of us feels like, or maybe I'm just projecting that, but there isn't any feeling of healing that's happening. When am I just listening and when do I try and, move that conversation so that there is a sense of, not that you need to change in their mind, but that there's something that we can be doing.
One of the things that I work with actually in all the classes I teach is actually really helping to encourage people and give us space where we can practice deep listening, because we do not get listened to much in our culture either. And I think as a practitioner, you can experiment with that. And of course, part of that is also having the courage to speak what is true. There are situations that are, where there very little dialogue is going to be possible. But I would hope that part of what each one of us would take on is being a little braver to engage, to just bring these discussions up in our ordinary lives. Because I am concerned that we don't talk about them in polite company. I think we need to. In fact, I was thinking, do you all know about death cafes? It's this movement of people coming together, often over like coffee and cake or even a nice meal, and having a conversation about death and about dying. And I think they started maybe in England, and they've spread across the country, and it's a way of kind of taking away the taboo of talking about death. They're wonderful. And I was thinking, maybe we need climate cafes. There's a wonderful project happening in Champaign-Urbana right now through a small organization there called the Cassandra Project. And there's 20 people from around the world that have come there. So, Cassandra was the prophetess that people didn't always want it to listen to. But basically, they are coming together as a group for 3 months to try to find ways of opening up that conversation and go back to their communities and new and creative ways to help people talk about these things. And they're actually starting climate cafes. So maybe we could start some climate cafes where each person's view, there was room for that to be shared, and room for us to change as we hear each other's voices. You can't underestimate the power of a circle of people speaking and listening deeply.